Hey, and welcome to Builders, a podcast from BetaWorks Studios about the amazing people who build things. The makers and the doers, not just the talkers. The people that are helping shape the world we live in. My name is Layla Aweda, and I'll be your guide. In Builders, we bring you a diverse mix of thinkers and leaders from the startup ecosystem. All of the shows are recorded live at BetaWorks Studios, our club for builders, located in the Meatpacking District of New York City. If you want to know what a club for builders really is, just visit betaworks-studios.com to learn more. But these podcasts are a pretty good reflection of life in studios. One week, it might be a discussion on crypto. The next, on how technology is affecting music festivals. This episode features authors Henry Timms and Jeremy Hyman's talk about their latest book, New Power. This book has been described as the definitive guide to spreading ideas, building movements, and leaping ahead in our chaotic, connected age. And New York Times columnist David Brooks calls New Power the best window I've seen into this world. Studios is a place for members and their friends to come together, learn, and spread ideas. This seems like a perfect session, so we're excited to bring you some of the highlights. So in this episode, you're going to hear Henry and Jeremy give a few examples of the new power versus the old power dynamic.
So I think of Harvey Weinstein as an exemplar, in one sense, of how do you exercise old power to preserve your position. He got away with this unbelievable spree of decades-long abuse because he understood how to command an industry. He treated power like a currency. He very carefully spent that power to reward his friends systematically, to punish his enemies, to create essentially a wall around himself of intimidation.
This episode's a little longer than normal, but that's because Henry and Jeremy had so much good stuff to share. They included stories on everything from Obama, Occupy Wall Street, the NRA, Elon Musk colonizing Mars, and of course, a book called New Power just wouldn't be complete without some reference to Donald Trump. They talk about how organizations can blend old and new power to their advantage to create a secret sauce, if you will.
Very few organizations who are good at pulling both, right? There's some who are very good at old power, there are some who are kind of good at new power, but getting that combination right, we think is kind of the secret sauce of the 21st century.
Most of this illuminating session was actually a conversation with the audience. As always, at BetaWorks Studios, there was a great mix of entrepreneurs and people from startups, both large and small.
My name is Ross Dakin. I work at a startup called Bank of America.
You're on message today.
Thank you.
You've had a good century.
I've got a couple questions.
This session was hosted by Rufus Griscom, CEO of Helio, who's also a BetaWorks Studios member. Helio runs something called the Next Big Idea Club, which you'll find out a lot more about in the session. Thanks for hosting, guys.
So much for coming tonight. I think this is our first official, I guess maybe our second official event for the Next Big Idea Club. We started the Next Big Idea Club because I think we've all had the experience of having books change our lives. I was just talking earlier with Tammy, one of our beloved early members of the Next Big Idea Club, who we were talking about the book Quiet by Susan Cain, which profoundly affected the way she teaches and interacts with the world. And we had, in conversations with Susan Cain and Malcolm Gladwell and Adam Grant and Dan Pink, four extraordinary writers, we concluded that we should really curate a collection of the books that we think can potentially change people's lives. And I think a beautiful sweet spot for new ideas and new books are books that help us better understand the world and in the process also better navigate the world. So it's sort of intellectually, cerebrally compelling, and at the same time actually applicable to our lives. And New Power is a perfect example of such a book. It's really impacted the way we at Helio and inside of the Next Big Idea Club think about our business opportunities. And so we're really honored to have Henry and Jeremy here today to talk about New Power. And I think the spirit of it is we really want to have a conversation. But because we know that not everybody has read the book. By the way, can I ask how many people here have read New Power? Okay, great. And how many people are part of the Next Big Idea Club? Fantastic. I'm concerned for those of you who are not yet members of the Next Big Idea Club. But that's a problem we can rectify because we have four boxes that we're going to give away And if you sign up to learn more about Next Big Idea Club with Eric in the back, you'll have a high probability, given the numbers here, of being one of four people to get a free box containing the Next Big Idea Club and our other excellent things in the spring box. With no further ado, we've got the co-authors of New Power, Henry and Jeremy.
I'm Jeremy, the very tall Australian. So my English co-author Henry, who's very anxious about the World Cup.
I'm not anxious at all. I'm feeling very confident about it. England, this is the year. I can say with some confidence we're going to win tomorrow 3-1. And you heard it here first. That isn't our topic this evening, but that's the breaking news. We'll think back on that tomorrow and think, I wish I put some money on that prediction. We're very pleased to be here, especially pleased to meet Tammy. Tammy, in the spirit of New Power, read this. We're going to round applause, Tammy.
Come in closer, Tammy.
Tammy does important work with students, we've learned this evening, particularly around civic education. And she has not only taken some ideas from the book and made assets for the students to use in their classrooms, but has actually done a lot of, even these badges I'm wearing now, these New Power badges. And it's such a good example of New Power at work, right? An idea that began in the book, which she grabbed and made meaningful for local students in Boston, which is now changing lives in Massachusetts. So we're very grateful to meet Tammy this evening. And we're very pleased to be here to talk about New Power. And we thought we'd start, given quite how badly everything is going in England. Other than the football, which is going terrifically well, the politics is going horrifically. So given where things are going badly in England, we thought we'd start with a story about things going badly
in England.
So here is a story about things going badly in England.
It's my pleasure as an Australian to share this with you. So there was a very sort of serious British research institution called the National Environmental Research Council. They spent £300 million a couple of years ago building a ship. And this ship was going to travel the world and do environmental research. Pretty bland, pretty the sort of thing that would not attract much notice. So they thought, we want to figure out how to engage the crowd in this work. So they decided to ask the crowd to help them name their ship. And the first sign that this might be going a little off the rails was when they sent a press release to people announcing this initiative with suggestions for what the crowd might actually call the ship.
Which included things like Shackleton and Adventurer and Endeavour, these very kind of grand, august British names. The campaign was called Hashtag Name Our Ship. And the British public, as it turned out, did not want to call the boat Adventurer or Shackleton or Endeavour. Within 24 hours, by some distance, the runaway favourite for what they should call this boat was Boaty McBoatface.
With some excellent other suggestions, including RRS, I like big boats and I cannot lie.
That sadly came 10th. We were hoping for more than that. So Boaty McBoatface goes viral in every way. 250 million Twitter impressions. It's in every pub. It's on every game show. It's on every the front page of every newspaper. It's on every TV show in the UK. The story of Boaty McBoatface provokes the guy who suggested this to be overwhelmed and actually put an apology out saying, look, I'm terribly, terribly sorry about all this. The crowd then turns on him. He retracts his apology and stands by Boaty McBoatface. It then crosses the ocean. The New York Times cover it. The CNN. CNN covers it. Boaty McBoatface is in every way a global viral sensation, other than for one man.
There's a problem, which is the science minister who's paid for the boat.
Who, interestingly, is not Boris happy. Johnson's brother. Boris Johnson, who has not had a terrific success with Brexit.
And interestingly, Boris Johnson's father described this book as brilliant, which we're not sure is a compliment or not. He's a very nice man. So basically, the science minister is not happy. He's like, this is trivializing science. This is a joke. How did this happen? He calls a parliamentary inquiry in which an expert is called in to explain how this went so far off the rails. At the end of the testimony, one of the parliamentarians asks him, just out of interest, who did you vote for? And he sheepishly says, Boaty McBoatface. So everybody's voted for Boaty. But what's interesting about this story is that even though there was this incredible moment of engagement around this name, it didn't work out.
So in the end, the science minister put so much pressure on this poor environmental agency, this poor government agency. They issued this compromise. They called the boat David Attenborough after the famous British... And quite elderly scientist who everyone loves. No one could really complain about that. And they named one of the submarines on the David Attenborough Boaty McBoatface. So in the end, they sunk Boaty at sea. That was the end of the Boaty story. And what was interesting about the story, in a way, it's a reflection, a fun reflection, and this book has some very dark moments, so we thought we'd start with something fun. It's a very fun reflection of kind of the themes of the book, which is we are entering this world where organizations like this scientific agency recognize that the power of the crowd is something to be harnessed, that there's this huge opportunity for people who can get their hands around the crowd and get it to surge in the direction they want it to. They ended up the wrong side of their crowd with Boaty McBoatface. But it points towards the core theme of the book, which is how do we all think about the power of the crowd and what it's capable of doing. So maybe we'll start with a couple of stories which kind of land the core concepts of old power and new power and how they speak to each other.
So think of Harvey Weinstein as an exemplar, in one sense, of how do you exercise old power to preserve your position. He got away with this unbelievable spree of decades-long abuse because he understood how to command an industry. He treated power like a currency. He very carefully spent that power to reward his friends systematically, to punish his enemies, to create essentially a wall around himself of intimidation. At the beginning of the book, we mentioned that there was a survey of the people most thanked in Academy Award speeches, and tied for first place with Harvey Weinstein was God. So you get the sense of, you know, for decades, despite all of this behavior, he gets away with this. And yet the Me Too movement comes along and sort of is a very different form of power, a very different exercise of power.
So if you think about the Me Too movement, which begins with the activist Tarana Burke, but then last October surges around the world, it's not in the way that Harvey Weinstein was power as a currency, that he's got it and nobody else have. It's power as a current. That movement gets stronger as it surges around the world. As every woman steps forward and adds her testimony, she strengthens the overall movement. Unlike old power, this is new power. It's distributed, it's leaderful, it's made by many, it's peer-driven. And see, even as Me Too moves around the world, it goes into different sectors and different countries, and that whole idea begins to morph. It surges like a current around the world. Think, too, of something like the Obama presidency. So you remember the campaign. Remember, the kind of classic new power campaign was the Obama 2008 campaign. Yes, we can. We are the change we are looking for. The kind of micro donations, all the agency people felt to volunteer, to create, to orchestrate his campaign. That was an incredible action moment of new power. But then think about his administration, and actually one of the great criticisms of the Obama administration would be that all that participation he used to get into office, he largely abandoned once in power. It wasn't a highly participatory presidency. In fact, it was a fairly traditional one. The thing he most often asked for was money. Third story.
So you think about the applications of new power that are not so positive, and really one of our key arguments in the book is these are neutral tools. They can be used by good actors, they can be used by bad actors. There was a Scottish schoolgirl we described early in the book called Aksa Mahmood. She had a supernormal childhood, she loved Harry Potter, but one day she found her way from the bus station in Glasgow, and the next time her parents heard from her, she was calling from the Syrian border. She joined ISIS, and she became this incredibly effective recruiter for ISIS. And it sort of illustrates the way that an ideology like that of ISIS, which is obviously advocating a medieval theocracy, nonetheless could be adapted by a teenager perfectly to lure other girls from the West to join ISIS. So we studied her methods. She'd created this kind of peer-driven network of girls. It was very intimate. There was all of this proximity that was created. You know, it was sort of, hey, you know, toiletries are not widely available in Syria, so this is what you should bring. If you need to leave your parents behind, here's how to do it. And connecting the girls to each other made that a lot easier. And then you contrast that with the way the US government sort of responds to the propaganda threat of ISIS. You think about their version of how to exercise power in this situation.
So the US government begins, when they're trying to counter ISIS's ideas, by flying bombers over Iraq and Syria and dropping cartoons out of the back of the bombers, paper cartoons. And on the cartoons are pictures of people whose lives end very badly because they've become jihadis. And these land on the heads of the civilian populations in Iraq and Syria. And that tactic was first used in the First World War 100 years ago. So they're using this very top-down, 100-year-old tactic. They then embrace social media. They realize that the paper cartoons probably aren't going to do the job. They embrace social media, and they set up a Twitter account called Think Again, Turn Away, helpfully in English, with the most enormous logo of the State Department, which they use to scold people who become potential jihadis. Obviously, that is also not super successful. So you see this world emerging. When you begin to look for it, you see it everywhere. You see this capacity with New Power, this ability to harness the connected crowd. It's what you see in the platforms like a Facebook or Uber and Airbnb who are making such progress. It's what you see in social movements like Never Again or like Me Too. Interesting, just as an aside, that in the last 18 months, we've seen the three biggest protests in US history, all generated by these kinds of New Power tactics. And you see some political achievements that no one expected, whether that's the election of Barack Obama or indeed the election of Donald Trump, where you see people who are working out how to harness the intensity of their connected crowd are those people who are seeing advantage in a hyper-connected world. So what the book says is, look, we want to do two things. We want to say, first, there is a way of thinking about New Power. All of us here, as you think about your own work, whatever you're trying to do in the world, you typically have got old power skills. You've learned that work. We've all learned it for a long time. The question is how you use New Power, how you spread ideas, how you raise money, how you think about leadership. There's a set of new skills that everyone needs to learn. So a lot of the book is a manual. It says, here's how you engage with this world. But more importantly than the manual, the book also tries to be a manifesto.
So we think a lot about the implications of this world, and it's not all good. We see this world in which both the people and the institutions that have figured out how to do this well, who know how to harness this incredible surge of participatory energy that we see all around us, are taking the spoils. So on the one hand, you've got what we in the book call the participation farms. They are platforms like Facebook, who are so effective at getting us all busy and distracted, but who are ultimately extracting all the value, really, for themselves. You know, we don't have any role in the governance of a platform that has become so critical to our democracy. We don't understand or even see what's in the algorithm that we now know sort of shapes our thoughts, our feelings, our political opinions. So that's a predicament that we're in relationship to these platforms, because they've figured out a way to co-opt New Power in a way that has very significant implications. And so in the book, we talk about what that means. We also talk about some promising alternatives. It's ultimately, I think, a pretty hopeful book. And the book ends with this manifesto about how New Power can truly make more people more powerful. We also identify the threat of what we call the platform strongman. And that is the political model that's emerging of leaders who understand these New Power tactics, you know, and they've always been movement authoritarians, but the new version of that has a lot of particularities. So think of Donald Trump. He's very good at an almost chaotic a harnessing of that crowd to really stir up energy, to cultivate the creativity of his most extreme supporters. And that's proven to be very effective. But he pairs that with a very authoritarian value proposition, which is also very alluring to some people. This idea that I alone can fix it, I'm here to solve your problems, I'm going to be that commanding authoritarian figure. And when you put those things together, you give people more agency and you give people that sort of strongman narrative, you can get a lot done, you can be very compelling. You see ISIS using a version of that strategy, you see Trump using it. You even see it being used in China by people like Xi Jinping. So that's kind of a world that we want to think about how we can change. And what does it look like for people and institutions to create forms of participation that don't end up in extremes or don't end up in co-optation? So that's kind of where we get to with the book. And so we would love to engage. We're so excited to have a bunch of people who've actually read the book already. So I'm sure you guys will have a bunch of questions that will allow us to get really deep in on it. And all of you who haven't read the book yet are getting a crash course. So we should open up the floor, yeah?
So, you know, I think it's really interesting that I feel like, you know, young people really have, they're privy to the platforms at which they can communicate, collaborate, and gain momentum. And what I think is interesting is that, you know, some people are invested in kind of considering ways in which ideas spread, but I wonder, how do we kind of close that generational gap, I think, that exists in regards to that sense of agency? You know, when we grew up, you know, there weren't those opportunities to do so. And so I know that in my classroom, I want that judicious pause to consider going from voice to action, because I think that that's really important. And that's what I really, you know, took away from the book, that with all of the anecdotes and stories, it was that consideration. So, you know, I'm curious how you distill that to this generation that is so connected through social media platforms.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Parkland kids are such a good case study of this. So you think about they within days had rallied millions. But it wasn't just that they had the technology tools. They had the skills of cultivating a crowd in this particular way where they could mix the power of their own personalities with the ability to give people things to do that made them feel part of the movement. They didn't create an institution called the Parkland Kids. They created something that was very open source and very ownerless. And as we see, many of the movements that are taking off have those characteristics. And I think our argument in the book is that whether you're old power or new power, you need to figure out how to blend the two. So you think about those Parkland kids, we would argue they should absolutely keep doing what they're doing in order to win and ultimately defeat the NRA. And the NRA, as those of you who read the book will know, is a big case study in the book of an organization that does know how to do this. They blend old power, they're fearsome, they have institutional might, with new power. They have this incredibly fervent base that they are very clever at cultivating and not damping down. Those two things are going to be needed in most effective strategies today. And so the Parkland kids are probably going to need to form alliances with old power.
And one example, if you think about that blending of old power and new power as a key prescription of the book, you think about the Next Big Idea Club. Think about this book club itself, right? And how interestingly it combines old power and new power. On one hand, you've got four of the most celebrated writers in the world deciding on the books they think you should read, right? It's old power, very old power idea, right? On the other hand, you're building alongside that this community of people who can take those books and take them into their own hands, organize meetups around them, create content around them, lead conversations in their own direction. So one of the interesting things about even this example itself is it's blending together the best of old power and new power. And I think that would be our prescription for any organization looking to shift outcomes in the world, is to work out when you want the old power lever, when you want the new power lever. And there are very few organizations who are good at pulling both. Right? There's some who are very good at old power, there are some who are kind of good at new power, but getting that combination right, we think, is kind of the secret sauce of the 21st century.
And that applies at the individual level too. So you think about leaders, people, all of you doing your work in the world, you need these repertoires.
I will say who you are, unless you don't want to, which is fine, but if as long as you're fine with the transparency, good new power
value. Or just a username. Yeah.
My name is Edward Radzivilovsky. I'm working at an internet startup called Gangsy. And I'm curious, when do you posit that the new power began? When you sort of say new power, it seems very new. I'm thinking of books like Uncle Tom's Cabin, which helped shift opinion hundreds of years ago. So when would you say it began, and what's the key defining feature of this new power? Is it social media?
Yeah, Jeremy posits much more than I do, so he can answer this.
This is how we handle hard questions. He just sends them right to me. The way we think about this is, from time immemorial, right, there's been a dialectic between movements and institutions, between networks and hierarchies. That's not new. But what we're trying to investigate in the book is what's particular about this moment that we're in. And our argument is that, think about Airbnb as a model. So that's a new power business model that is enabled by, you know, ubiquitous connectivity. Now, it's true that 20 years ago, there were catalogs that were sent every season where you could swap your house or apartment with someone else. But of course, you could never do that at a scale or a speed or a density that meant that whole cities were transformed in terms of their real estate stock and dynamics by a network like Airbnb. So that's the difference. So our argument is that this ubiquitous connectivity, you know, which is a phenomenon of the last 20 years, has enabled new models to emerge and very quickly has accelerated a new mindset, which, of course, has its forebears in many of these bottom-up movements, but looks quite different in the early 21st century. And frankly, if you're thinking about what strategies to use, today, using new power just like has a higher, to use business language, ROI than it did 20 or 30 years ago when it was incredibly difficult to mobilize people at scale quickly. And so all sorts of new possibilities get created.
Hi, how's it going? My name's Aaron Trujani. I actually don't work in a startup, but I'm interested to hear what you guys think about the sort of blending between the sort of physical social space and the online social space in a place like Betaworks, for example, and how those things, you know, blend old and new power and also a strategy to achieve something like this, for example.
I think we get stuck in a bit of this. There's always this danger of this kind of old man binary around it's only real change if it's in person, that all those people on the internet don't know what substance is, right? That argument, I think, is boring and false. So I think there are plenty of genuinely human, profound, meaningful experiences that happen all the time online when people congregate, right? You see that happening all the time. So I don't think we should accept at face value the idea that life only exists at face value. Right. I think there actually are moments that people have very meaningful online engagements, conversations. Anyone who has used Skype to connect with relatives around the world, any classroom like Tammy's where kids can engage with kids on the other side of the world and work out what their lives are like, recognize the truth in that. So I get away from this idea of kind of online bad, offline good, but think about how we blend those moments together in important moments, and think too about how important it is for people to want to congregate, whether online or offline. It's really interesting that again, from this book club itself, what people have wanted to do isn't simply read the books that people recommend. What people want to do is start their own clubs. Right? The biggest organic activity coming out of this community isn't people saying, yes, please, Malcolm, tell me what to read next. That's not what they're doing. They're saying, give me a prompt and let me go somewhere interesting with this. So I think if you're thinking about how you congregate, about how you get people around your ideas, the lesson in this is how do you give people very meaningful agency, whether that's online or offline. I don't think it really matters at this point. And frankly, as VR and AR become more mainspread, that whole space is going to get so blurry that what's going to matter is actually agency rather than experience.
And what's going to matter, I think, is thinking about the difference between what we call your participants and your super participants. So can you cultivate the agency of those super participants? And a lot of that activity will happen, you know, some of that activity will happen offline. I think we're great believers in the face-to-face group as a means of building connection and community. We think there's enormous power in that, which is why these book clubs that you're part of are so exciting to us. There's no doubt that there's some power in that model. And technology can scale it up and can create discoverability. You know, we were involved with the women's marches at the organization I run Purpose, and we created, you know, technology, which meant that anyone could like put their hand up anywhere in the world and say, I want to start a women's march in, you know, Gainesville, Florida. Or even in, you know, Nairobi, Kenya, and people did. So that's kind of the elegant fusing of those two things.
My name is Ross Dakin. I work at a startup called Bank of America.
You've had a good century.
I've got a couple questions that are a little bit related. The first, I'm interested in your view on, is there a polarity of new power? In other words, we've heard about examples where it's used for things that we might think are good. We've heard about ways that it's used for things that we might think are bad. And related to that, I'm interested in your view on regulation of new power. When I was in federal government, there are all these rules, right, to make sure that you can't accept gifts from people. In your minds, is it appropriate to try to limit new power? Is it effective? Are there examples of where it's been done well?
Yeah, so the regulation piece, I think that's, so there's some really interesting challenges emerging. There's a great community called the Night Scout community, who is parents of kids who are diabetic, who have hacked together essentially an insulin monitor, which their kids can wear during the day, which does continuous tracking, which allows them to see what's going on. And obviously it's been very liberating for a lot of kids and parents in that community, but it was hacked together using Pebble. So it works off Pebble. Some parents hacked it together. They've all been improving it in a collaborative way. And they were faced with this challenge, which is like, this clearly should be regulated to some degree, but who's going to regulate it? There's not really a company involved. There's not really an application process involved. So this kind of collective of parents who had hacked together this app essentially submitted themselves to the FDA and said, what are we supposed to do about this, right? And it's a really interesting challenge, which is you're seeing these new models emerge, and the old power regulatory structures aren't designed to meet them. So I think there is definitely a place for regulation. In fact, it's essential in a world where there are so many dangerous things entering the marketplace and so many ideas that actually are very bad for people. Take the anti-vaccine movement as just one, which gets some direction. We have to regulate, but we can't expect the old power forms to regulate in new power ways. So I'll give you an example from Taiwan, where this has been done effectively. There's someone we admire a great deal called Audrey Tang, who began as an activist and ended up in government. And she's trying to hack together government, essentially to reimagine government in a new power world. And they were having the same problems with Uber that people have had all around the world, that everyone was fighting with Uber, and Uber was fighting with everybody, and no one knew what to do about it. And they used a platform which actually allowed them to crowdsource the regulation of Uber. So they worked out how to invite all these different people into a conversation, work out what the most likely consensus position was, and use that consensus position to formulate the regulatory strategies. So I think we're at the beginning of a kind of a reckoning where new power regulation will become interesting and quite quick. And I'll let Jeremy deal with the difficult question on polarity.
But I think on regulation, our kind of call to action to the kinds of people, you know, who hang out at BetaWorks is we need to think of this as a kind of quite political cause. So at the moment, you know, we're seeing the damaging effects of some of the concentration of power that's coming from these platforms. That said, a lot of the regulators who might be in charge of figuring out what to do with it could easily squash the benefits to users of those platforms because they don't really understand them and they're not going to be focused on that as much as they are just on kind of eliminating risk. So I think the opportunity are for people who get this stuff to, A, be strong political voices applying the right kind of pressure on these platforms. B, invent new models that do these things better. So if we think about the damage being wreaked by Facebook in terms of, you know, it's very extractive economically, it is very untransparent and secretive. These are all things that smart technologists can build new platforms around. And certainly with the blockchain, the opportunity to sort of re-decentralize the internet is real. So, you know, solve the problem, guys.
Yeah. Which was an answer in some degree to the polarity question, right? The polarity is going to be who's going to pull this in the right direction. And I think that thus far, if you had to kind of judge the contest, I think we have seen the platforms and the strongmen take a lead on new power. So the question is how we push back against that. And I do think that's a design issue. I think Jeremy's right about that, that actually we need, this is an engineering feat now, which is how do we create platforms and systems that allow participation, but actually in themselves are more democratic and more participatory. That seems to me the great technology challenge. Yeah, and I'll give you just an example, which there are lots of ideas that we had this rule with the book. We'd only put things in the book if both of us agreed. So this is one of the ideas. So we also use these sessions as therapy for ideas that Jeremy wouldn't let me put in the book. So one of the ideas that Jeremy wouldn't let me put in the book was the greatest act of philanthropy of the 21st century would be if Mark Zuckerberg were to say now, what's interesting with people with technology is they make a bunch of money out of technology, then they become a philanthropist and go do philanthropy. That's what Bill Gates did, right? He made a bunch of money in technology, went and became a philanthropist. Wouldn't it be interesting if what Mark Zuckerberg did is said, look, I've got all this control over Facebook. My great act of philanthropy is to work out how to return this to the public good. I'm going to work out how to return Facebook to the public good because that would be the biggest way I could actually shift to the world he wants to believe in, this community he wants to build. He has very, very smart people surrounding him right now. He has a governing control over Facebook. This is algorithmically very complicated, but it's morally compelling.
Interesting, but not interesting enough for the book.
I think Jeremy's wrong. I'd like to take a live poll.
Yeah, yeah.
Who thought that was a good enough idea to be in the book?
The paperback is an opportunity. You guys are really polite.
Yeah, no one likes my idea. Jeremy turns out was right.
Hi, I'm Amy Gidden. I really enjoyed the book. I'm developing a mobile app that might be a little tiny antidote to the social media conundrum we're in. We'll see. Stay tuned. But your discussion of Facebook makes me wonder whether new power or old power is more easily corrupted. And once corrupted, I think we're talking about Facebook's intent being corrupted, I would say. Is it harder to undo when power is new, when it's new power?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, the concentration of power is a challenge in this context because the nature of networks is that once you have the network, you've got all the network effects. That said, I think the direction of travel is turn things like the walled garden of Facebook is not inevitable. We can break that up. That's what regulators can do. You know, the idea that platforms could be completely interoperable, so I could take all of my data and all of my content out with me seamlessly out of Facebook into another platform would radically transform the landscape because you'd end up having a much more fragmented landscape, much like email ISPs. Like, you know, that's a highly fragmented market. We all have different ISPs, we all have different email addresses, but we can all talk to each other seamlessly. So I think there is a model that, you know, that may need regulation that would push people out of the walled gardens, that would make it easy to move, because the rationale for being able to switch from AT&T to Verizon seamlessly is much the same as the rationale for being able to get out of Facebook easily. And I think we might start to see things like that happen. And maybe they'll even do some voluntary stuff, because in a choice between that and being actually broken up by regulators, the way that Microsoft was broken up in Europe in the 2000s, I reckon they'll choose interoperability.
Hi, good evening. My name is Chris Zeller. I am an executive recruiter here in Manhattan. I come from the financial services industry and have family in the healthcare industry. And so one of the things that's always been, you know, kind of kicked around the table in my house is this idea of informed consent. And in the book, you guys talk about participation. And so with data being the new currency in many, many ways, I was wondering if you'd share your thoughts on informed participation as we embrace this new power movement.
Nice term. I mean, that goes in the paperback edition. attribution.
So I think one of the great moral trades is always liberty and security, right? How much security you're prepared to trade off for how much liberty. One of the interesting trades now is actually with liberty and frictionlessness, right? That actually what we're prepared to trade off is a lot of liberty for a lot of frictionlessness. If things are made very easy for us, we'll give up a lot of liberty quite quickly and quite quietly, right? When was the last time you checked the terms and conditions of anything? We've been trained that terms and conditions are essentially to be ignored so we can get back to our cat videos, right? That's literally how we think about our rights. Just think for a moment about that. We think about our rights as something to be scrolled through and ignored quickly. I think that's quite a dangerous thing. So I think one of the things about participation is we often get seduced by participation because it is so rewarding. And it's much more rewarding than our rights. Our rights are typically quite boring, right, until you really need them. Right, what you're in the moment, you're experiencing these great moments, these great dopamine rushes. And so I think one of the structural questions, and again, this is a good question for this room. One of the structural questions is, how do you make informed consent informed and interesting? Because there's informed consent, which is boring, which is people telling you you must do this and must do that, and that just hasn't worked for a long time, right? We know that doesn't work. Like doctors for a long time told everyone to eat their vegetables and they didn't. So the question becomes how you actually structure for participation. We use that phrase again and again in this work, which is actually how you make the act of doing public goods an enticing and attractive thing, and that's the build challenge. So I think about informed consent as really a way of creating feedback around important civic goods.
I had a question about you mentioned blockchain earlier as a potential sort of utopian category. What we're seeing with, at least with Bitcoin, is that that power accrues, it's just to a different place, not necessarily on the consumer side, but you have the Bitcoin miners who are all, there's like 5 Bitcoin miners in China who can control the fate of the category.
Yeah.
Is that inherent to any network? Is that no matter what you do, they're going to be hubs? Or is it possible to create a sort of true democratic network?
Well, I always think that kind of there's a blockchain is to incorruptible as Titanic was to unsinkable, right? So there's this kind of belief that, oh, wow, it can't possibly corrupt it. And the same thing happens again, which, of course, Tim Berners-Lee was warning about years ago now, a decade ago, which was you have these kind of perfect paradises and people come along and they build things on top of them and the paradise itself is still paradise, but you've managed to capture the value on top of whatever you've created. That, of course, we've heard this story before. That was the story of the World Wide Web. You look at the hopes, the utopian visions around that at the beginning. So I think we should be very careful to get too overly excited about these technologies and assuming they're democratizing powers. But I do think, to Jeremy's point, this is going to be all of our jobs. All of our jobs is going to say these product design questions are not just product design questions, they are the democratic questions of our age. And how are we as activists, as designers, as bankers, as regulators, as educators, how are we engaging in these conversations, actually pushing outcomes in the right direction? Because right now the big danger is the most powerful people are simply becoming more powerful with a better algorithm, right? The new boss is the same as the old boss, but he's now got this amazing algorithm which is holding all of us in his hands. So I think that becomes the right question to think about.
And look carefully at who these people are. I mean, that's the thing. You look at the...
Well, you can't, though, with the Bitcoin. You have no idea.
The point is exactly, like, the kinds of people who are shaping these platforms, unfortunately, look a lot racially, demographically, etc., like the last generation of elites, you know, with a slightly different dress sense. But that's a real concern, right? So that's, you know, if you want to think about how power changes, you know, it's not going to be changed by another group of, you know, nerdy white guys.
Hi, my name's Kirsten Lambertson. I'm a longtime internet entrepreneur, and also I'm a volunteer with a group called Ragtag, and I was the lead on the dev team for the March for Our Lives website before they had a big march. Just got done launching Resistance School, which is a bunch of classes for anybody who's interested, online video classes about civic engagement, how to build movements. And as a digital entrepreneur, what occurs to me all the time about these things is the threats to them. It's very exciting to see things like Me Too happen and March for Our Lives happen, but I think about the threats to them and how when everybody gets together around a hashtag, it makes them a target. And I haven't read your book yet, but I'm going to. And I'm very curious if you've done any thinking around threats to the new power, that the digital threats, cyber threats to the new power, and how easy it is for someone to come in and pretend to be someone they're not and change the conversation, as we're seeing with a lot of bots pretending to be Democrats leaving the Democratic Party this week and last week.
We think a lot about this. You think of something like Sesame Credit, if you know about that in China right now. Sesame Credit is essentially it's designed as a point system for citizenship, whereby your online participation, you are rewarded with Sesame Credit, and Sesame Credit is issued by the government. And if this rolls out as they suspect it will, your participation online will allow you to get better rates on loans and better deals in stores. And essentially, as long as you do pro-government things, your life will get better in China, right? So we think a lot about the threat of that. And obviously that all feels very foreign until we get to things like facial recognition with Amazon, which is big in the news right now. And very quickly, that's going to be part of our lives, we suspect, without a strong pushback against it. So the threats to all of us is by stepping forward, we essentially step a long way back because we've given up some part of ourselves, I think is very real in general. And it's very real in specific. There are lots of groups of minority voices, of people who have been oppressed, of people who are being very brave and stepping forward, who then are turned on by the mob. A lot of those issues are getting more and more real by the day. And I think one of the goals of this book was to highlight some of those threats and hope that what the book would do was push people who are doing work in areas like yours to think that actually the work you're doing is going to be the civic construct of our age. If we get that stuff right, then we'll be able to protect people and sustain people. If we get it wrong, we play quite lazily into the hands of these mega platforms who just get bigger and richer. And the more of our data we give up to them, the more of our lives we give up to them, the more threatened we are, both in immediate ways, but actually much more in these quiet, seductive ways, that day after day after day, the world gets a little bit less democratic, and we're still, quote, participating, close quotes.
Thanks. I'm Michael Kovnat, a part of the Next Big Idea Club. Just have a quick question about politics and political parties. It strikes me that Occupy Wall Street strikes me as an example of a new power movement that never allied itself with old power in a way and sort of had a relatively short shelf life, as opposed to something like the Tea Party, a sort of more right-wing version, which did somehow become a more influential on the U.S. Congress and has had a more of a lasting presence. I guess I'm just wondering if you think there are any, I don't know if you think in terms of politics in this way, but if there are any distinctions between the left and the right in their success and ability to blend old and new power.
Mm. Yeah, the Tea Party Occupy thing is interesting, isn't it? I would argue that the Occupy movement did put income inequality on the map, but I agree that it fell short of its much bigger potential. And that was partly because there was a quite lefty ideological abhorrence of any form of kind of consolidation in that movement. So, you know, if you were there at the General Assembly, you know, it was so inclusive that it would take hours to debate the most simple of things. And they were also, interestingly, in a funny way, they really were resistant to any co-optation of the idea. So they didn't want people to make an Occupy Party or an Occupy this or an Occupy that. They tried to kind of wall that off. Whereas actually they should have allowed for people to take it and use the frame even more than they did for institutional purposes. So I think that's really interesting. I think the Tea Party did do a better job of taking what was an initial wave of grassroots energy, which actually fizzled pretty fast, and then they moved in with all these institutions and turned it into something that lasted, you know, a while longer. So I think the lessons are a couple things. One is, you know, it's important for us to understand that those people who don't care about truth or facts, who are prepared to play to people's worst instincts, will start at an advantage. because you're unconstrained, and that's compelling. So that's an important thing to note. And so I would argue that people advocating for, you know, liberal values, liberal democratic values, have a little bit of a disadvantage when faced with sort of right-wing populists. So that's one dynamic to think about. And then, yes, I do think that progressives need to be a little bit less ideological about process and get better at blending those things. And some of the exemplars in the book are doing this in interesting ways. The Black Lives Matter leaders and co-founders are thinking very smartly about this, the right combination. They're always engaged in this discussion with themselves about how much structure, how much agency. And that's always the question that we should be asking ourselves as we think about these different movements.
I'm Rufus. I continue to be Rufus, also part of the Next Big Idea Club. Elon Musk was asked the question relatively recently, once you colonize Mars, how are you going to run it? or what's the optimal form of government for Mars or for any new place? Which I thought was kind of an extraordinary question. And his answer was, I think it's going to be largely referendums. We're going to have a lot of referendums.
Oh, God. It sounds terrible.
But this gets to, when you think about the founding of a nation or a planet, gets to the core of this question of what is the optimal balance of new power and old power? Because when you think about the founding of this country or any other country, there really is a blend of new power and old power built into those systems. And of course, we're coming off an election where a lot of people in this room are kind of unhappy with the Electoral College and some of the systems put in place that may be less relevant today than they were then. Technology changes the way that new power and old power can function. I think it's an interesting thought experiment. Say, what do we think today is the optimal balance of new power and old power in the way that we govern? I think campaign finance reform is something that would perhaps reduce negative, you know, unhealthy old power. But it seems like there's an emerging view here that there is an optimal balance, and it's not all governing by referendum, probably.
I don't think new power is direct democracy, right? New power is actually about richer forms of participation. So I would not ascribe referenda to the new power column. So I think this question is the more interesting question is, at a time when people feel really alienated from all the institutions in their lives, like they think political parties suck, they don't think government delivers for them, they're very alienated from systems and institutions, and they're much closer to the platforms and networks that are, you know, in their everyday lives. How do those institutions better serve people and give people a deeper, richer sense of connection to them? So if you interact with your healthcare system, you know, how do you find your way into a group of other patients who are solving some of those problems, like those diabetes parents that Henry described? If you're an educator, you know, what does it look like to not just feel like you're subject to a kind of an old power teaching model that doesn't engage you? That's how we get to, a richer experience of democracy, you know, not sort of shallow forms of engagement.
I'm Josh, by the way. I work at a startup here in New York in advertising marketing. It seems like the blessing and the curse of new power is that it reaches so many people, but in order to do so, you kind of have this lack of nuance. And, you know, you want your message to be as broad as possible and understood by as many people as possible. Are there, like, problems with not being able to be as nuanced as some ideas require using new power? Is that something that could end up being a challenge to some of these movements? I think about Parkland, and you have some people supporting gun control and others supporting school safety. And on the surface, both sound like great ideas. Like, who wouldn't want both of those things? But, you know, school safety means something very different.
I think there are lots of ways. The flashpoints that we see of new power are, I think, probably do fall into that world. But actually, there are lots of ways in which people can be very nuanced with new power. I'll give you an example. We were in Australia recently, and there was an academic journal there who had reimagined all of their work to make it more straightforward. Without reducing the quality of the content or thinking, they've made the language much more accessible, and they've made the function of the journalism much more participatory. So rather than the old power version of that with these long peer-reviewed papers with language nobody understood, which no one had access to, they're putting those ideas into the marketplace. They're assuming people are intelligent. They're working out smart ways to engage people in those rhythms. And by doing that, they're actually putting nuance into the marketplace and powerful ideas. So I'm actually largely convinced that there are lots of ways that we can engage in nuance at scale with new power. this book club is an example of it, right? It's a huge thirst for people to have very nuanced conversations about things. So I don't quite buy that central argument, but I do think that's going to be hard work. I think one of the problems is that people in charge of nuance are so used to the old power world that they like their old power world, and they buy that argument, which is an appealing one, which is, well, you know, all this populism will just reduce my message and they won't understand it. And I think people are more intelligent than they get credit for. So I think one of the things we talk a lot about with this work is that the great distrust of institutions, right, the great theme of our age is people don't trust institutions. And the reason for that is institutions don't trust people. That they actually aren't finding ways to engage them in this work. So I think the challenge is on our institutions to work out ways of scaling nuance. That seems to me a very good rallying cry for the academic world in particular.
So just so you know, inside backstory in the writing of the book, Henry's derisive nickname for me while we were writing the book was Mr. Nuance, and my derisive nickname for him was like Mr. Tweet. So we...
I don't think that's quite fair. We have these sections and Jeremy say he needs more nuance, which usually meant that like this very perfect bit of lyrical writing would be ruined with some kind of riot vibe.
So there we are. You see the sort of bubbling tensions in this new power model.
Which we've held together for 3 years.
Yeah.
And they may come undone today.
Hey guys, so I'm also Jeremy from the Next Big Idea Club, and we actually have a question from our online audience, if that's okay.
If we said no, what kind of statement would that? No, we're good.
You like, have to answer to this guy.
The crowd people.
So this question comes from Dave, and he asks, how do you feel about the public versus the professionals when it comes to debating what good art is?
Ooh, what a great question.
Very
right? Yeah, kind of interesting, right?
So I run the 92nd Street Y, which is a cultural organization, community center in New York. And so we think a lot about that question. And I think there are two. Here's my optimistic argument. I think the arts are in terrific shape. And there are lots of people who run arts institutions who would tell you that's not true. That things are bad and people don't pay attention and no one listens to classical music anymore. And there's a whole raft of arguments. We've never had more musicians in the world, we've never had more dancers in the world, we've never had more painters, we've never had more writers, we've never had more broadcasters. Around the world, there is this huge surge of artistry taking place right now. And it's a very, very exciting time in the arts. It's just not a very exciting time to be an arts institution. Now, I think there's a place for professionalism. Clearly, there is greatness in the arts. Clearly, there are things that we should learn from. There are disciplines, there are experts, and they can play a role. But the idea that they're being drawn out of their castles and have to enter this much more crowded world, I think, is very healthy for the arts in the longest term. And I think, if you think about it, one of the most human of all things we do is we are artists. So I've 92nd Street Y, for those who don't know, we're a community center. We serve people at all stages of their lives. And one thing I see every day is everyone, we have kids in the school from 0 to 5, a lot of young kids. They're all artists. And then we have lots of seniors who are kind of 70 plus, and they're all artists. And what you realize is actually our careers are essentially just a distraction from our career as artists, that we begin life and we end life embracing the arts. And what's so exciting about the arts right now, think about Instagram, think about Snapchat. These are all moments of creative expression, which previously we could never share with anybody, right? And now we can share them with so many. So I'm very bullish on the future of the arts. I'm not very bullish on the future of arts institutions.
Musical.
So I'm Alex, and I have a strange question.
How strange?
Hear me out.
All right. I want to prepare myself.
So there are some terrible ideas and bad movements. How do we stop them from spreading?
How we stop what from
bad
spreading?
Movements.
Bad movements. By having stronger movements that are good. I mean, that's the only answer. That's why we wrote the book. We want to arm people. That's why we're not, like, you know, doing training sessions with the NRA.
They haven't invited us.
No, you can take that gig. But it's really, like, it's a good point. And I think that the argument that we make, and Henry alluded to this earlier, is, like, there's a sort of a snobbery, particularly on the liberal side, on the kind of... the rationalist side about this stuff. It's like, we're right, you know? We have the facts on our side, all this evidence. That should be enough, right? And, it, you know, you see that attitude in everyone from political leaders to billionaire philanthropists, etc. So our argument is, look, you know, don't go away from truth, facts, evidence. Absolutely continue to cherish and embrace those things, but recognize that those ideas have to move sideways. So when we think about this book and why it matters to us, we think about the climate scientist who, you know, who has the truth on her side, but who needs to do a better job of making those ideas move. as she faces the climate denier, or the doctor who's taking on anti-vaxxers and trying to keep his community safe. So those dynamics require good people to develop this new muscle that we think of as new power. And there's no other way to do it, because these ideas are out there and these new tools are out there and anyone is going to be able to get their hands on them. So the only way for us to do it is for those on the side of some of these liberal democratic values to do a better job of prosecuting them. Sorry, I didn't have a silver bullet for you.
All right, thanks. We're going to wrap up. Please stick around. These guys can hang out and talk for a while. If you want to find out more about the Next Big Idea Club, talk to one of us or sign up in the back. Thanks for coming, and hang out, have a drink, and have fun.
So, to recap, that was Henry Timms and Jeremy Hymans. They can be found on Twitter at Henry Timms and at Jeremy Hymans. Simple enough. Their book, New Power, is out now. If you liked this episode of Builders, there's a really good chance that you'll like the episode featuring Jaron Lanier and his new book, Why You Should Delete All of Your Social Media Accounts Right Now. You can listen to that episode by subscribing to Builders on all of your favorite podcast platforms. We don't just do books, though. We have episodes on blockchain and Instagram and the current ad agency model. And for more info on all of the upcoming live events at BetaWorks Studios and general membership info, just visit betaworks-studios.com. Hope to see you at some of them soon. Until next time, I'm Leila Oeda, and this was Builders Podcast. Happy building.